Zechariah means Jehovah remembers. God remembers his people and remembers his covenant, and going to look after them and care for them. The name Zechariah occurs some 27 times in the Old Testament. So when Jesus spoke of Zechariah being slain between the altar and the temple, why, it's uncertain as to which Zechariah that was. Either it was this Zechariah, we know nothing in the world about it. It was another Zechariah that was so slain. But we don't know for exactly who he was talking about. So now 27 different persons of that name, it's hard to keep some of them straight, and I think that's why. This time that Zechariah mentions himself as Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo. That identifies him from the other 26 that are named in the book. The book of Zechariah is an unusual book. It's like Nahum. Nahum was different. Habakkuk was different. He went to God with his question. But this book is different in several respects. First, it's the longest of the minor prophets. Second, it's the most difficult of the minor prophets. We'll be most uncertain of our interpretation of any of them. Very difficult book. Has several particular characteristics. First of all, one of the characteristics is, I've just said, the longest book of the minor prophets, the most difficult. Second, it's the most messianic of the minor prophets. I think it comes up with Isaiah as being messianic. And we'll point this out and we'll go along. It's the most messianic of the minor prophets, and almost equal to Isaiah, except the length of it, in dealing with Jesus as the Messiah. That's the second characteristic of it. The third is its emphasis on angels and visions. Now, angels in the first six chapters occupy a very important point and place in those chapters. More than any other book. Also, it has more visions. In the first six chapters, you have eight visions in one night. And if we study these eight visions in one night, there we're trying to interpret them as best we can. Some of them I'm not sure of, but I'll give you the best understanding I can of them. But the eight of them in one night in this first six. Now, the difference between a dream and a vision is that generally a dream takes place while one is asleep. Generally, a vision takes place when one is awake. Being awake, he sees this. Now, whether it's with the eye or the eye of the spirit or what, but he sees something there in this vision. Now, that won't be literal, but there'll be a literal person that he sees in the vision. So it's very peculiar in that it has so many visions in it, and that some of these pertain to the Messiah. Right? When it comes to the Messiah, he deals with the Messiah as the branch. Well, so did Isaiah, the branch of David or of Jesse. He is the branch. It also deals with him as king. It deals with him as high priest, and deals with him as shepherd. Is all of that. And so that makes it a peculiar in its presentation of the Messiah. It's so definite, positive in some of those matters there. It points out there that their situation, their destruction, was because of their not keeping the prophets or obeying the prophets there. So now then, if you just listen to the prophets, come back to God, God will remember you and do what he said he would do. So it's an unusual book in those several respects, and I think you're going to enjoy it. Another thing peculiar about it, all the heathen forces are going to be destroyed before the Messiah comes in the Messianic kingdom. will be predominant over all other kingdoms. Well, of course, now Daniel pointed that out, and other prophets pointed that out, but he's more specific in it. He points out the definite destruction of all the heathen nations, and then the reign of the Messiah that will reign over all these will be first above all of these. So these are some of the things we have to look forward to in our study of the book of Zechariah. And when I wrote my commentary on it, it's now about 20 years ago now, I thought once, doing like one of my former students who went on and got a PhD and was teaching in Harding, head of one some department in Harding, especially the graduate school there. He wrote, one of the students told me that he was in his class when he came to Zechariah. He just simply said, I don't know enough about this to teach it, we're going to pass over it. And he sort of just gave a summary of what it said without going into what it might have meant. I thought about doing that when I came to write on Zechariah. I said, no, that's unfair to anybody that buys the book. I never did like to buy a commentary that would have to spend two or three pages on a passage that anybody, a 12-year-old kid ought to know, comes to something difficult and he skips over that or goes around it or under it. He passes over it there. He celebrates the Passover when he comes to a difficult passage. I bought two or three of the Advocate commentaries years ago. I didn't want any more of them because I found that to be true of them, and every time something was hard, I couldn't find them saying anything about that. If it's something I already knew, to write a page or two on it. Well, that wasn't what I want in the commentary. So I decided to tackle it. I guess about a fifth of my commentary deals with this book alone, the book of Zechariah. So at least I've tried to grapple with it, and if you differ from me on my interpretation, be fine. If you won't accept it, it'll be fine. I'm not dogmatic about it. No man can be dogmatic when he comes to the book of Zechariah. So we'll just tell you that to start with, and we'll get right on into it. Now, as to the background of it, it's the same background that you have with Haggai. Now, Haggai began to prophesy in the second year of Darius, the king of Persia, and about 2 months later, Zechariah was called to prophesy. So he comes in that same year, 520 B.C. Now, let me just repeat what I said Sunday before last in introducing Haggai, that the Jews were carried into captivity, the first Jews were carried into captivity in 606, right? And about that or five, either one you want to give it there, I'm not sure of that date. And the group came back in 536. Right? Now that gives you 70 years of captivity here. In 70 years of captivity. I'll mention another 70. The temple was destroyed in 586, and the temple was completed in 516. So we have another 70 there, a 7-year period without a temple. So I mentioned those two periods there. So the group came back in 536 and laid the foundation, and that's all they did. And 16 years later, then they began to rebuild it, and 4 years later, they had it completed. So we have those 2 70-year periods there that you want to keep in mind. And so when the prophet said the 70 years is spoken of by Jeremiah were fulfilled, that's the 70 years of the period of, I don't know which one or the other, probably the period of captivity there. First group in 66, the second group in 586. Well, at any rate, we leave now with that. That's enough for the introduction of it. The background then is the same as it was in Haggai. Now, the people did not go ahead and build a temple. Haggai was raised up by God as a prophet to tell them to finish the temple. All right, he got the job done. He got them moving on. Then Zechariah was called to help him in that, but to look beyond that unto the coming of the Messiah. He's more messianic than Haggai was. Now let me just outline the book briefly. In chapters 1 to 6, we have these visions. are the eight visions in one night with some a little more material than that. But at any rate, you have primarily visions. Right? Now, chapters 7 and 8 deals that with the question of fasting. They come to him with a question, why should they fast on certain days? And he dealt with this question of fasting. Now, those two chapters, and I believe it's the 58th chapter, I'm not sure, I think 58th chapter of Isaiah, those two, three chapters, those three chapters deal with this question of fasting. So we'll deal with it especially in this. Then the last chapters here, chapters here, 9 through 14, six chapters there, 14 chapters, that deals with the nations, the heathen nations, when I say nation, that's a heathen nation, versus the kingdom of God, God's kingdom here. Right? So those are the most difficult chapters. These 9 to 14 will probably be the most difficult for us to try to interpret. So if you really want to know anything about the book, you're going to have to do some study along during the week after I've told you what it seems to me it teaches. Maybe I'll open the door. You can do your own study on this if you're interested in it. It's a great little book. I hope you do get interested in it. I called in now to the office of and the second, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom, and behind him there were horses, red, sorrel, and white. So here then is one rider, and then here are others back of him. And I think this rider, the red horse, is probably the angel of Jehovah, which in the old covenant was the word of God that became the Messiah, came the Christ. Remember that God was with the children of Israel in the wilderness, Paul says. Christ was. Christ was with them all the way through. It always was the word of God, the one through whom God was acting back then. So I think this rider of the red horse is my guess now, that this was the angel of Jehovah, who was the Christ, the messenger from God, the Christ, the Messiah, pre-incarnate, before he took the form of flesh. So you see, he always was. When Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am, he has always been. Micah, you remember the 5th chapter and verse 2, who is from old, from everlasting. For he is from everlasting as God is from everlasting. But he was pre-incarnate, that is, before becoming flesh, and was with God and was with the people back there as the angel or messenger of God, Jehovah, unto his people back there. You find him, the angel of Jehovah, over and over there, back there. Then you find many other angels. All right, so here then, he's with him among the myrtle trees. Now, that's a bush that grows up, the flowers, over in that country. And say they were in the bottom or lowland. Now, that's probably a low place here where they were. Maybe signifies the low condition of the Jews at that time. They were in a very low state. They needed encouragement. For God now is going to speak to them in these visions through Zechariah and encourage them to go on and build a temple, serve him, and what he will do in the future now. All right? So, and here, I wouldn't try to tell you what these colors represent. Some think the red is war, and the next one there, the sorrel, is famines and those things, and the next white is victory. But I don't have any basis particular on which to base that. So I don't know what to signify. I'm sure there's a signification on that, maybe it, but I don't know that. So we'll pass over what I don't know. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And I notice he didn't say, who are these? He said, what are these? In other words, what do these horsemen represent? What do they signify? I'm not interested in who they are, but what are they? What's God teaching us through them? And the angel that talked with me said unto me, I will show thee what these are. Now there's a question whether this angel that talked with him either rider of the red horse or another or a different angel there, that actually the interpreter. Possibly the latter, possibly the first. I've read arguments on both sides. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, "These are they whom Jehovah hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth." And they answered, the angel, that is now all of them answered, I mean in chorus, which you can have in a vision, you wouldn't have it in normal conditions, but in a vision, yes. What? And they answered the angel of Jehovah that stood among the myrtle trees and said, "We have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest." Now, most of us think, well, that's a good condition, but it doesn't suit God, because it shows that they are self-satisfied, they're self-sufficient. They feel self-sufficient in their conquest and what they are and all of that. And God, remember back in Haggai, said in that second chapter, "I'm going to stir up the nations. I'm going to stir them, and they'll help you build this temple." Now then, they haven't been stirred yet. They're sitting there, complacent, self-satisfied. Right? And so this is what the angels, or these horsemen, in the vision, say. Now we've been going to and fro through the earth. Here's what we've seen. Now verse 12. Then the angel of Jehovah, now that's probably the rider of the red horse, answered and said, "O Jehovah of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 80 years? That's from the time we were destroyed until now, the time that first were carried into captivity, whichever one you want to follow there, to that 70 years. Now then, how long before God's going to end? Now here's what I mentioned to you some time ago in Habakkuk. Habakkuk asked how long. God didn't answer the question there. I made the statement, as far as I had found, only one time God ever answered that question. It was Isaiah. I think I've found a second time. They asked the question, how long? I think God answers that in this next verse or two. Now let's look at it carefully. And Jehovah answered the angel that talked with me with good words, even comfortable words. So the angel that talked with me said unto me, "Cry thou, say." Now here's what God said. "Thus said Jehovah of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy." Now, jealousy, it comes from a word that means zeal or zealous. But to be jealous is to have zeal for one of whom you love, of whom you fear another is going to supplant that love. So jealousy is not the same as envy. Envy is to begrudge an individual what he has. Jealousy is to feel zeal for one you love and fear of being supplanted in the love of that one. Now, here's a man jealous of his wife. That is, she... a woman will turn it around, a woman jealous of her husband. Either way, the husband is playing around. Now, the fear is she's going to be supplanted in the affection of this one. Therefore, that's jealousy. God was being supplanted in the love of those people by the idols which they were worshiping. Therefore, God was very zealous for his people. Zealous for them, jealous that he was being supplanted in their affections by the idols whom they were serving. You see the difference there? Envy is to begrudge an individual what he has, but jealousy is to feel that I'm being supplanted in the affections of one by somebody else. That was the way God was jealous. "And I am very sore displeased with the nations that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction." Right, so God is displeased with the nations now. He was displeased with his people. But the nations were the ones that cruelly carried them away into captivity. Well, now, God used them for that. But he still, they were held responsible for the disposition they held and developed there. So remember that. God may use an individual, but he's still guilty. Just like in Habakkuk, the second chapter, verse 10 and 11, you remember. Here was Nebuchadnezzar, or the Chaldeans, and they came and took the land. God said, I'm raising them up. But they passed by and be guilty. Even he whose God is his might. So they were still held guilty. Notwithstanding, God had raised them up and used them. They were guilty of developing the character and the disposition that they manifested. Right? Same thing true today. Jesus selected Judas who would betray him. He didn't make Judas bad. Judas made himself bad. He knew that Judas had reached the point he would, in his wickedness or in his development of character, he would not hear what Jesus said. He would not be affected by it and would sell him over 30 pieces of silver. Right? Therefore, thus saith Jehovah, I hear three things. I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. That's first. Second, my house shall be built in it, saith Jehovah of hosts. Third, and a line shall be stretched forth over Jerusalem. Right, now let's look at these three. I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. That was a word of encouragement. God has sent them away into captivity because of their wickedness. But now I'm coming back with mercies to rebuild the nation that I cast off. If you listen to me. Now second, my house shall be built in it, saith Jehovah of hosts. Now, although you've been slow in getting to it, you're discouraged. You're not happy over the progress you've made, but God's given the assurance, yet I'm going to build that house. You're going to build it. It's going to be built. All right, then the third thing was, and a line shall be stretched forth over Jerusalem. It'll be measured by Jehovah. And when God brought them back, he would do better by them than he had before to their fathers. But now remember, that was conditional. When God said, I'm going to do this, then that's conditional on what? On their doing the will of God. All right, when he brought them back, they didn't do that. Waited around all this time to build the temple. And then they began to fuss among themselves when Nehemiah came. Why, they'd lapsed back into many of the old ways. And then after that, why, they turned to the... Let me get back now to my chapter and finish this up. Now here's a second vision. And I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, four horns. And I said unto the angel that talked with me, what are these? And he answered me, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And Jehovah showed me four smiths. Then said I, what come these to do? And he spake, saying, these are the horns which scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head, but these are come, that the smiths are come, to terrify them, to cast down the horns of the nations, who lifted up their horn against the land of Judah, to scatter it. All right, now this is one vision of two elements in it. All right, there are four horns, and the horn is a symbol of power. Four horns, and here are four smiths. Now we call them blacksmiths. They used to, and all the boys don't have them anymore. But anyway, that's one vision. Now the four horns, four is the world number, four corners of the earth, the four winds of heaven, the four great beasts out of the sea, and all of that. So four is the world number. Now that summarizes the nations of earth, the world number. All right, now here then are the four horns, simply the powers, the world powers, that came against God's people, destroyed them, and carried them away into captivity. Now the four smiths are four blacksmiths, or whatever, who will now destroy the four horns. So God raised up the horns. Now then he raises up the smiths that are going to destroy the horns. So what you have in this vision is the destruction on captivity of Judah, of Israel and Judah. And now then, that God is going to destroy those nations. Well, of course, you have the same thing in Daniel under different headings. Here was Daniel, the head of gold, the breast of silver, the belly and the thighs of brass, of brass, and the legs and feet of iron. And then those same four are the four beasts of Daniel 7 that came out of the sea. One like unto a lamb, another like a leopard, another like a bear, and another a great and terrible beast, nothing to represent, four great nations there. Those particular ones symbolize the Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Alexandrian, and the Romans. But in Zechariah, not any particular four, but all of the heathen powers and nations that had come against Israel and Judah to destroy them. All right, now God will raise up those powers that will destroy the destroying powers. Now, I'm trying to point out to your class throughout our study of the prophets that over and over is set forth in the prophets. That here God raised up the Assyrian, he raised up the Babylonian, whole Assyria, the rod of mine anger. Lo, I raise up the Chaldeans that did a hasty nation. Come on, the 44th and 5th chapters of Isaiah. Here is Cyrus, Jehovah's anointed one, to destroy Babylon and to release the Jews to come back. And then he raised up Alexander the Great, the Macedonian, to destroy the Medo-Persians. And then they were split up. Then he raised up the Romans, who destroyed Jerusalem, and God destroyed them. And then they've been a world power since. So over and over, God does this. And I pointed out in the New Testament, Jesus then has a rod of iron. In Revelation 12 and 5, he breaks the nations with a rod of iron. Same thing in the 19th chapter of Revelation, here on the horse there, in judgment, sword out of his mouth, and he destroys these nations. He treads them in the wine press. So you see, you have that taught throughout the Old Covenant, have it taught through the New Covenant, and yet people fail today to recognize that principle. We've got to recognize it. So here then, the four horns symbolize the great world powers, all of them. Four is just the world number. So here are the world powers that destroyed God's people, but here are the smiths that God's going to raise up to destroy the horns, that power. But finally, God's going to bring them to an end, establish his kingdom, and there's never been a world kingdom since that time. Roman was the last. Charlemagne tried to establish one, he failed. The British tried to build one, they failed. Kaiser Wilhelm tried to conquer the world, he failed. Hitler tried to do it, he failed. Anybody else who tries to establish this United Nations, which keeps talking about trying to build a world nation, never do it. Why? Because the languages all have been are different. About a language, I mean the nation, the character of the people are different. You can't amalgamate them. So we'll never have a great world empire again. Jesus Christ controls the only one. And that one is spiritual. His fills the earth. From sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Dominion does that. So he's the head of the only world empire. All right, well, I'm going to stop there. And he lifted up there when they're going and scattered Judah. Now in the next one here, you have a man with a measuring line. We'll take that one next time. Then you come on down here from him over in the third chapter. I'll probably get both those chapters next time. The third, you have cleansing of priesthood, Joshua and the priest there. All right, we'll get to those two next time. We'll try to take a couple at a time there. Have any questions before I leave this? Right, so Jehovah remembers. Now they come back to you and say, I'm going to build my kingdom, I'll build my temple here. Jerusalem will be my capital. I'm going to come back and you'll be my people. We did all that, but the people didn't do what they came back to do. They were not faithful to God. It looks like that to me is one of the great points of proof of inspiration of the Bible. God took a nation that was always in rebellion against him, refused to do his will, and through that brought a great principle right into the world through the prophets in Jesus Christ that stands out by itself as a monument to the fact that God did it in spite of all the opposition of the people he chose and the nations also. If that doesn't prove it, I don't know how you could. Believe the lesson there. All right.